Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. Yes, it's still me, just a little nasally. I promise I'm not spreading any germs over the radio. Lisa Province, I promise not to spread any germs to you across the table.
Okay, Rick, I'm going to hold you to it.
Lisa, thank you for being here today. Lisa Province, a long-term journalist. I'm familiar with you, Seville Weekly, The Hook, back to Seville Weekly here in Charlottesville, but elsewhere, right? Your history as a journalist goes elsewhere?
No, it pretty much started and was in Charlottesville. It was like a midlife career for me. And so I started 22 years ago. My first article published in a weekly newspaper was Seville Weekly. And so that was my trajectory, which is a little different from what most people do.
How do you start a journalism career midlife?
Well, I spent my, you know, after college, I worked for IBM, and I was in corporate communications. And that was, you know, that was just a world I didn't see myself being in the rest of my life. And then I had a hiatus during childbearing years, so I didn't work for a long time. And then when I started working again, it was like I liked the writing part. I wanted to write about things that interested me. And so from going to starting with featurey sort of pieces, then starting reporting on local news turned out to be the most fascinating thing I've ever done.
What was your first article?
Oh, gosh. It's it was about local spas. So, that was how I started. But then once I started talking to people and, you know, being able to look into subjects a little deeper than what's the best deal at the spa. It was just amazing.
Lisa Province is here with us today because you haven't retired, but you've moved on from Seville Weekly to becoming a freelance journalist, correct?
Yes, I am freelancing, and I have retired, and I'm just going to say I highly recommend it. It has been so great. But what's also really good is I can still report for Seville Weekly. I did a story this week for them, and then but it's also just not having to go into an office is pretty swell.
So, again, our guest today is Lisa Province. We're going to talk about her career, some of the great articles that she's written, some of the more interesting, some of the more vexing is a word she sent me. So, but let's start with one of the more difficult that you had. As I cough throughout the hour with my water bottle. You were sued this year.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a story I had written about the plaintiffs in the lawsuit against the city for voting to remove the Confederate statues. And I would say that's probably one of the biggest themes throughout the past few years, these statues and how we deal with our racial past. So anyway, this was, you know, the lawsuit went on for, had gone on for several years, and I did a piece on the people who were suing. And one of those people comes from a first family of Virginia. They were one of the largest slave-owning families in Virginia. And so this person just felt like, with me writing about his slave-owning history, that defamed him or portrayed him, implied that he was a racist. And so he sued me, he sued Seville Weekly, he sued UVA professor Jelaine Schmidt for defamation, and I am happy to report that that was thrown out of court the end of October, and so that was gone. But it was an interesting note to end my full-time reporting career with, now I'm sort of in the news.
How does this happen? I mean, you're trying to write the news, and I mean, how is that you write a news article and you get taken to court? Because can that happen at any time now? Can any journalist be taken to court for any reason?
Yes. Yeah. Anyone can sue anybody, anytime. The grounds, I mean, you really don't have to have realistic grounds. And that is one of the reasons that some states have these laws called SLAPP laws. And against these lawsuits, and SLAPP is Strategic Lawsuit Against Public Participation, where some people just regularly do this if there's somebody whose voice they want to silence. An example that I'm familiar with that I think came from the West were developers getting a lot of blowback from projects they were trying to do from citizens, you know, for whatever reason, and they would sue the citizen activist group against it. So even if the case is later going to be dismissed, you know, that ties up money, it ties up energy, you know, to have to deal with a meritless lawsuit. So that was part of our response to this. Was we were hoping, under Virginia just a couple of years ago enacted an anti-SLAPP statute, and we were hoping under that to recover the attorney's fees for this lawsuit. Now, for whatever reason, the judge in our case did not award attorney's fees, and so at this point, we're not pursuing that. But it did kind of raise the question, if there was a suit that should be applicable, you would think this one would be.
Judge Rick Moore, I'm unrelated to him, correct?
I thought you were Rick Moore.
different.
Kidding, of course.
Did any of the other folks in that article file suit?
No.
So the other 12 folks in that article were fine? Did anybody else contact you and say, I'm unhappy with this article?
Oh, yeah. I think a lot of them were unhappy with it. There was a lot of chatter about it. And there were a couple of errors in it, which I corrected online, as, you know, journalists do that when you make a mistake. You correct it, do that. And so there were people, I could tell, not happy with it, but nobody sued, and nobody, aside from a couple of things, relatively minor things, nobody said, you've got this all wrong, and even the person who sued me in the suit said, we're not saying it's factually inaccurate. We're just saying that the way it's presented implies that he is a racist, which of course was not, you know, that that was just I can't, you know, you can't think about what are people going to infer when you start putting down a set of facts. That's
Seville Weekly. You don't work for Seville Weekly any longer,
right?
Did they stand behind you in that lawsuit?
Yes. I was an employee at that time, and fortunately, there was insurance, and so So that was really great. Jelaine had a different situation with the University of Virginia. For whatever reasons, determined it could not represent her, even though the university encourages public participation by its faculty in issues surrounding the community. But she was represented by the ACLU of Virginia. So they took on the case, and they were specifically interested in testing out the new anti-SLAPP statute. But, again, that didn't pan out for us, but it's something that, you know, people may want to take a look again at.
Again, our guest today, Lisa Provence, recently retired from being a journalist for Seville Weekly, is now become freelance, still putting out articles. Your last one, you said you just put one out.
I did, and this, oh my goodness, it had to do with the statues again. there have been, because, you know, as you know, they've been vandalized, they've been defaced, and some pretty seriously, like chiseling away the noses of Valor and Faith at the base of the Stonewall Jackson statue. And I mean, I do think that's serious, because regardless of how you feel about these things, you know, actually hacking them and
it's one thing to move them; it's something else to damage them.
Right, pretty much irreparably, or at least it'd be a serious repair job. So people have started. People who want to keep the statues have started guarding them at night in the parks, and that has resulted in some confrontations that that other people feel could be potentially dangerous. They are saying that people, you know, are pretending like they're city employees, or they wear vests that say security. One person who is in the activist community said she was going through the park, and this guy in a vest said, "You have to leave now. I'm securing the park. I'm securing the park." And he wasn't a police officer. I mean, it's a public park. It's open until 11 o'clock. So there have been that kind of encounters. And then Jelaine Schmidt, again, was in the park. And a guy came up to her and flashed a badge and said he was an undercover cop and wanted to know what she was doing in the park. And so, of course, you know, she's feeling like this is a public park. Why do I have to justify why I'm here? And how do I know this guy is a real cop? Because there's these other people going around acting like they're security or they're in some official capacity. So it's gotten a little confusing. And so Jelaine she does these monument tours. You may be aware she takes people through Court Square and, you know, has a lecture on the monuments that are there, the statues, and how they fit in to, you know, this background of the Confederacy and the whole slavery issue that, you know, we're still grappling with today. So she does that tour. So she decided to do one Monday night. It's sort of an impromptu, but, you know, close to 40 people showed up, and I went on that, and as well as some of the people who have been guarding the statue. So it's just another, you know, it's just more fallout on having these statues in public spaces.
Let's talk about, you listed to me your favorite interview in 22 years mm-hmm. was with John Waters, the artist, movie director, et cetera.
Writer, stand-up guy, and artist certainly too. And yeah, he was here for the Virginia Film Festival, and I'm, it was 2009. I was looking at that again, and so 10 years ago, and it was a dream. I will confess that I have followed John Waters since the 70s, and I will always remember seeing pink flamingos for the first time, and I think it changed my life. I grew up in North Carolina, and I had just never seen anything like that. And even though I watched movies and probably saw more foreign or, you know, than many of my peers there, but it was just like, oh my God. So I was intrigued and have watched his movies my entire life. And so to be able to interview him, it was just, yes, it was definitely a highlight.
How do you set up an interview with a really famous person?
Well, it helps, for one. It helps if they're coming to the film festival or the book festival, or because if they've already agreed to do that, then usually those institutions are, they want publicity for it. So I'm pretty sure, you know, the film festival helped me set up this interview with him. And so I was hoping I could go to Baltimore and, you know, see where he lived, or one, he has a lot of houses, but check out his residence there. Or I was willing to fly to San Francisco, or, but unfortunately I could only get a phone interview.
I read the article, the interview you'd done. He was also talking about a book that he had coming out, and I guess you had read a chapter or so in his book, Role Models.
Yeah, that. Okay, I did read at the time. We're 10 years out from that. But the one I think I remembered reading was the one he had done on Leslie Van Houten, who
yes.
has become a big advocate. And for people who are too young to remember the Charles Manson murders of Sharon Tate and her friends, and then the LaBiancas in L.A., Leslie Van Houten was one of Charles Manson's minions who had this hold on people, and there were these horrific murders. She's in prison for life. In the course of that, John Waters, who he says in his book, he used to be pretty glib about these, you know, horrific crimes and looking more at the sensational aspect. But as he got older, he became more aware of, okay, there are victims here, and in many cases, the victims of the crime, and then the people who, the families of those who committed the crimes, and the people who realize that they've done something totally horrible, and you can never change that. And he says Leslie Van Houten is one of those people that she, I would say she's probably spent about 50 years in prison now, and, you know, is totally changed her life. But so far, she's continued to be denied parole. But he's always been interested in people like that. I mean, Patricia Hearst is another one that is a friend of his who had, you know, a different situation. The heiress who was kidnapped and then turned member of the, what was it called, Symbionese Liberation Army. And then she was convicted of a robbery or something in the course of. So anyway, he's always been drawn to characters who don't fit nicely into molds. But that was his most recent book at that time, although I'm pretty sure he's had other books since then.
Did you get to meet him when he came to the film festival?
No, I didn't try to meet him, but I had met him before years ago. In California, there was a divine marathon in the Castro Theater that went on all night. And just when I was about to leave, there was something really great. Anyway, I met him then. I got an autograph, and I usually don't like getting autographs. But that one, yes, I had a brief meeting.
Lisa Province is here with us today, has moved on to become a freelance journalist. We're talking about some of the articles and some of the pieces that she's done in her history, talking there about her favorite interview in her career with John Waters. I'm going to come back and talk about a decade
of wrongful convictions. Hang tight.
All right, we're back in action with Lisa Province. Sunday morning wake-up call here. Thank you for being with us today. Lisa, I think when folks who've been in the area for a long time are familiar with a name or two, but they don't always put them together. And you've had the insight to put these names together. And then when you sent me this information, hey, what articles are you interested in talking about? And I see these three. And I was like, wow, you know, what is Charlottesville, Omaro have a problem? I don't know if this happens in every area as wrongful convictions, but so let's talk about them for the next segment. Robert Davis. Tell us the story about Robert Davis.
Okay, Robert Davis. Well, the story actually begins with a horrific murder in Crozet in 2003. Neighbors wake up, see smoke coming out of this house on Kling Lane, and firefighters come. They put out the fire. When they go upstairs, which has been pretty badly burned, they discover the body of Nola Charles and her three-year-old son. He had died of smoke inhalation. Nola Charles was bound with duct tape on a bed there and had been stabbed. And her throat was cut. So that was, you know, just in anybody's neighborhood, it was horrible. So shortly after that, four kids, pretty much all connected through Western Albemarle High School, were arrested. Two of them were brother and sister who lived across the street. So in the course of the interrogations, they said Robert Davis was involved in this. Robert lived down the street, had never gotten along with the Fugits. Those are the kids. And so, but anyway, he was arrested. He had the police call, tell his mother they wanted to talk to him. And she thought maybe he could help with the case. That's a typical thing that police can do. And he was arrested in the middle of the night at a Walmart in Stanton. They threw him on the ground, arrested him, took him into jail and interrogated him for hours. He repeatedly said, I wasn't there. I had nothing to do with it. I didn't do it. He was kept in a room that he was cold. His leg was shackled. He was really uncomfortable. The cop interrogating him was one that Robert had known from his time at a school that he had attended for a while. So he saw this as a trusted figure. So finally, the cop interrogating him says, you're going to face the ultimate consequences or something. If you don't tell the truth, your mother threatened his mother. It was just, it's since become, considered a textbook case of false confession, because finally, after hours and hours of this, Robert, who kept saying he's tired, he wants to go to bed. If you want to arrest me, just do it. I want to go to sleep. Finally, he says, what can I say to get me out of this? And so then he's pretty much spoon-fed this confession. This is also typical from experts I've talked to in false confession, is that you will say almost anything just to get out of this uncomfortable situation. You think, okay, I can clear things up in the morning. And that's been, and also teenagers are susceptible. People who are drunk are susceptible. People who are, you know, exhausted. There are a number of factors that can contribute to make people more likely to do this, because it's a concept, you know, people just have a hard time getting their heads around. Why would you confess to something you didn't do? But in any case, Robert confessed. He was, he ended up entering an Alford plea, which is saying, I'm maintaining my innocence, but I understand the state has enough to convict me. He was sentenced to 23 years in prison. So after this happened, about 3 years after that, one of those kids that was convicted, his name is Rocky Fugit. He wrote Robert Davis' lawyer and said Robert had nothing to do with this. And so he, you know, went on the record saying that. He also said someone else was named in the who was involved that was never charged. And that is another, you know, another aspect of this case. But anyway, so I wrote about Robert in, I mean, first in depth in 2011. And it was just, it was one, you know, at that point I'd covered a lot of cases, but it was just one that was so, you know, profound for me on so many levels because it was this horrible crime. I live in Crozet. I was acquainted with some of the people. I knew Robert's mother, Sandy Seal. I didn't know she was his mother for a long time. But anyway, and it was just, you know, I met Robert, and it was one of those horrible things. I mean, I realize another trend in the stories that I've been attracted to, or, you know, have been the most important for me, are those that parents who have lost their children, or parents who have their children, I mean, parents who've had their children do horrible crimes. You know, those, I think as a parent, I just, and so I've felt, I mean, like, what would it be like to have your kid locked up for years and years for something you know he didn't do? I mean, they're, so we will flash forward. I did the story, and Robert's attorney, Steve Rosenfield, filed a petition for pardon that languished for probably 4 years until finally in 2015, about this time, Terry McAuliffe signed a conditional pardon for Robert and got out of prison. By that point, he had, you know, he'd been there almost 13 years.
That's amazing that he denies involvement. I read some of this information from your article. Robert Davis denies involvement in the crime 78 times, Denise being at the Charles house 76 times, and police are allowed to lie. He's interrogated more than 5 hours, beginning at 2 a.m. Police are allowed to lie. He's interrogated. And then he does the Alford plea.
Right. And then to further, I mean, I will say the good news, Robert is out. He seems to be doing really well since he's been out of prison, but still 13 years of your life. One tragic aspect of this is that barely a year after he finally got out, his mother, Sandy Seal, died in a car crash. And, you know, it was just like, it was shocking and so sad. And I had interviewed Sandy probably a month or two before that happened. And she was there with Robert. And I think it took, I can't remember, he was ultimately, the governor completely exonerated him. And, you know, he got compensation. But anyway, at that point, Sandy was saying, what I learned from this is I always told my kids, you know, before I said, Robert, you know, the police want to talk to you, go talk to them. Now I would never do that because she said, I didn't know they could lie to you. And, you know, that if Robert had not talked to them, there would have been very little. You know, that's just another lesson that young people sometimes aren't aware of, that you do not have to talk to police, and or certainly you shouldn't do so without counsel. But, you know, when you're a kid, I don't know that you know this.
Talking about wrongful convictions that Lisa Province has written stories about. By the way, that story is on readthehook.com. Even though The Hook is gone as a weekly newspaper, the majority of those articles are still around, right?
Yes, thankfully they are. They are archived on this. I mean, because, you know, Seville Weekly owns the Hook archives, so they are available online. And yeah, that's.
I mean, that's wonderful because so many. I mean, the Hook won state awards for the fabulous writing that was done, and so those need to be saved, and so thankfully they are.
Yeah. I mean, I think they're an important part of Charlottesville's history, so yeah. I am glad that they're still available.
So another wrongful convictions, Mark, is it Weiner?
I'm not sure, but let's say Mark Weiner. Yeah.
Tell us that story.
Oh, gosh. That story. Mark Weiner was a Food Lion manager, and he was coming home from work one night. He gives a girl a ride because it's cold. I believe that was December, and drops her off. It turns out this young woman was trying to make her boyfriend jealous. And so she pretended like she had been abducted, and she was sending texts and, you know, pretending that her abductor was texting this boyfriend to taunt him. Anyway, he was so alarmed, he calls the police. Then once this, you know, I mean, charade had begun, she decided to go with it and described Mark Weiner, the guy who had picked it up. She somehow had miraculously escaped from this, you know, abandoned house that was within walking distance of her mother's apartment or condo on Pantops. So she's home. She's fine. But she's like, oh, yeah, I had to escape. And anyway, he was arrested. He went before a trial. During that trial, there was some evidence that some, both the defense and some cops felt was exculpatory, that was showing the pings from her cell phone were coming from her house. She was never at the abandoned house. So anyway, but he was convicted. I first became aware of this when, the Hook was still operating, and I was contacted by a defense attorney. I mean, it was, you know, Mark Weiner's attorney said, this is a really, you know, there's just something really wrong. I've never seen anything like this before where this evidence is being kept out. And so that's when I first became aware of it. In 2014, I wrote a story about this, and, that had, you know, trying to put together all of this. And so then Mark Weiner got a new attorney. At this point, he's been convicted, but he hasn't been sentenced. So he gets a new attorney, and his name is Stephen Benjamin, and he is really, you know, he's definitely a guy you'd want if you're facing serious crimes. But he kept dogging it and digging up new witnesses who would say, oh yeah, she was lying. She's been to this house before. She knows where it is, the abandoned house that he took her to. And so all of this doubt kept coming up. And meanwhile, the judge proceeded and was still wanted to convict him and send him on and said, well, you can deal with this on appeal. And I think a lot of people were outraged by this case. Because as the evidence stacked up about his innocence, the Commonwealth, the court maintained that he, you know, no, we're sure he did this, and it went forward. And it wasn't really until this young woman, the accuser, was caught, I believe, trying to sell cocaine to an undercover agent, or not an agent, but you know, they use people to buy and sell drugs. And that's when the prosecutor dropped dropped the charges against Mark Weiner. I believe at that point he had been in jail 2.5 years. And so his family, I mean, you know, they lost pretty much everything because it's so expensive to defend yourself on things like this. And it was just, it was a case that, again, I think just a lot of people really took notice of.
Unbelievable. So let's do one more. Decade of Wrongful Convictions with Lisa Province. And that's in the Charlottesville area, a very famous one, which is Jens Sehring.
Yeah. Now, Jens, I will say I have not followed it and written about it as in-depth as many reporters have.
But he and his girlfriend, you know, the death is of his girlfriend's parents back in 1984. And yeah. Jens... takes the blame because he thinks that he's going to get sent back to Germany, which is where he's from. That's not what's happened. They're both convicted of murder.
And yes, kept in that's the United States. Yeah, that was another. I mean, this is a story. There's been a documentary made about it. It's gotten international attention, and certainly again Charlottesville. Because these are both UVA students. Both were Eccles scholars. Jens was a Jefferson scholar, too, which is, you know, that's a really big deal. And this was his first girlfriend, and she was a couple of years older. And I think he, well, clearly would have done anything to protect her. But her parents brutally murdered in Bedford at their place called Loose Chippings. That was the name of, you know, their house, their farm. And so once he realized that he was not going to get any kind of immunity, he quickly recanted his confession but still went to trial. It was the first trial that was televised in Virginia. And as far as I can tell, pretty much the only one. I mean, and so there were so many things in that, like later the attorney he had was disbarred for his contact. And anyway, so flash forward, Jens has been in prison for, 30 some years. Yeah. I'm sorry, I'm not going to try to do the math. And so he was just released on parole last month. And so he's still here. I will tell you, Sandy Houseman interviewed him this week at the Farmville, I think it's a detention center for people who are going to be deported.
Local NPR, Sandy Houseman from the local NPR.
Oh, sorry.
NPR.
But she borrowed my digital camera because she couldn't take her phone in. So I'm hoping I'll have some photos and, you know, at least we'll hear what's going on with him.
But you had, were there two articles? One because he was, because it went from one, he was not pardoned. How does it go from one way to the other?
He's been paroled.
Paroled, but then...
And then he's been kicked out of the country. He has to go leave the U.S.
But Charlottesville, our county sheriff, Chip Harding, says that he believes that he's truly innocent.
That was one aspect of this that was very unusual. To have law enforcement like that, and Chip is, I've followed his career for years and years, and he is, you know, serious about putting away the bad guys, but now he's taken into this thing of getting the guys wrongfully convicted out.
Again, our guest today is Lisa Province, who's now a freelance journalist. So we'll be right back. Let's take a break. And here we are back with our guest today, Lisa Province, and talking about some of her most memorable articles during her career, some of the favorite articles during her career. You know, we were talking about the decade of wrongful convictions, Robert Davis, Mark Weiner, Jens Sehring.
And that's not all.
No.
No. I think I was when before the break we were talking about Sheriff Chip Harding, and it's been interesting his pursuit of these sorts of cases, because there was another one. This was from Culpeper, but a kid named Michael Hash was wrongfully convicted, and that and Chip had investigated this. It ended up a federal judge ordered him released, and there was a shocking amount of corruption in how this was handled. But basically, authorities in Culpeper shipped Michael Hash down to the Charlottesville Albemarle Regional Jail, put him in a room with a known snitch, and then, you know, kept him there barely maybe a couple of days, then shipped him back up to Culpeper. But in the meantime, they, you know, said, oh, he confessed. He confessed to this snitch. And so that was sort of what his conviction hung on. I met Michael Hash when he got out of prison. My first wrongful conviction that I was, you probably have heard of Earl Washington Jr. Yeah. And he was wrongfully convicted. He came within days of being executed. And it wasn't till years later, somehow, I believe DNA evidence was what cleared him up. And I was at the case here in Charlottesville in the federal court where he was suing the people. And I was talking to Steve Rosenfield, who said there's another wrongful conviction that you might want to look into at some point, Robert Davis. So this was years before I actually wrote about Robert, but it does seem to have become a thread here.
Is this, as a journalist, and I realize that Central Virginia is your specialty, but is this something that you see in the Central Virginia area, or is this a problem throughout the United States?
Oh, I would say it's throughout the United States. I mean, we remember the Central Park kids who were
for the subway, right? Is that where that took place?
No, it was in Central Park where, again, a woman was brutally attacked. And somehow these four African-American kids who happened to be at the park at the same time, but they were convicted. They, again, there were the false confessions there where these interrogation techniques were used. And that was one, they have all since been exonerated, but that was one of the cases, I think, that was played a big part in the founding of the Innocence Project. And people started looking into this on how either people make false confessions or the people who are in prison who did not actually commit the crimes for which they're convicted. We have, Virginia has another notorious case, the Norfolk Four, where these sailors, again, were convicted of a brutal murder, even though later the guy who did it, who was in prison, I think he confessed and his DNA matched up with that scene. But these guys, I'm not sure that they've ever been absolutely exonerated. So anyway, it's not unique to this area at all, but certainly we've had our share of high profile cases.
You mentioned it, and as I went back and read through the three wrongful conviction articles, Robert Davis, Mark Weiner, and Sari. And again, you can read these in cville.com or readthehook.com. And I don't remember which one you specifically mention this in, but 21 days in Virginia and the difficulty it is when extra information is found after 21 days has passed, that it's difficult to bring that up in your case in Virginia.
Yes. I mean, Virginia is a state that once they've convicted you, the state does not really seem interested in hearing new information. That's my, and the 21-day rule, I mean, for example, let's look at Robert Davis. He pleaded guilty under the Alford plea, but it was still, it was like three, I would say at least 3 years later before Rocky came forward. He sent a statement to Robert Davis' attorney and saying he wasn't there. That was, okay, that's past 21 days. That's, I mean, it just, I don't know. I don't understand that, but I think criminal justice is going to get, you know, a new look, and in many areas it is. And, but that has also been, you know, the case. Mark Weiner, I believe, had some, you know, some of the hesitation was that it was past the 21 days. I think, I'm not, you know, I may need to double check that. But anyway, it's in some cases, it's slowed justice.
Again, Lisa Provence here today, freelance journalist now, 48 minutes after the hour. Let's talk about, I love this, you titled it your most vexed article, where you wrote about Phil Delaney.
Well, that came from a situation that I, perhaps like many, many other people who have ever been to the entrance of the Blue Ridge Parkway and Skyline Drive up on Afton Mountain, will come and see this derelict village of a former Howard Johnson's, a motel that has trees growing up through the roof, and then up on top of the mountain, it was at one point a Holiday Inn, but there's a hotel there now that is like, it was like a mid-century version of Bates Motel. Or, I mean, it's shocking. And yet you look and this has to be the most prime real estate in this part of the state, if not even, maybe, you know, two national. And so it's just been one of those things that, you know, I've seen, and a lot of people have seen, and go, what is going on here? Why is there not a place? Gee, I'd like to buy a soda, or I'd like to get gas here. There used to be a gas station that's gone. Why is this here, and why is it in this condition? Well, that is because of one person, I would say, who owns this property. And it turns out that Phil also owns Swannanoa. It's a National Historic Landmark that was built during the Gilded Age by James Dooley, a railroad baron from Richmond who built it. There are other prime properties. Another one people perhaps may be familiar with would be across from Boar's Head, Charlottesville Oil, where there used to be the big tankers, but, you know, it's marked by abandoned cars and right beside Farmington, you know. And so anyway, that it was just, I just was trying to look into this and trying to understand why someone who has such prime commercial real estate in this area, and yet everything is dilapidated. So that one was called, I believe, The Ruins of Afton Mountain, Eyesores Along a Scenic Byway. But that was just one. It was just a story that people all over this area have gone, why is this like that? And so I don't know that I can provide answers, but you know.
That's just part of the article that I read, was not everyone has done that, because several of the county administrators didn't do that when you interviewed them. Augusta County and Nelson County said, well, we're okay with that because.
Well, Augusta County was okay with what everyone's very careful about what they say. And so Augusta County, because Phil let them put up a visitor center, it's in this mobile, you know, unit. up there, and they paved some. So they're, you know, they're not saying anything. I mean, the most people will say is, well, yes, we would like to have a hotel and, you know, there, but, you know, so it's just, there's really nothing they can do. I mean, this is, if you are against eminent domain, this is a success story, because no matter, I mean, and when I talked to Phil, when I was writing the story, he said he can do what he wants. And that's true. He owns this property. It's his. He can do what he wants. So.
Let's talk about August 11th and 12th of a couple years ago and white supremacy. You were kind enough to participate in a radio show that Sunday Morning Wake Up Call did, where we interviewed multiple folks who were downtown or doing their piece. And curious about your articles. And then you also took what you called a profound trip last year.
Yeah.
Talk about that first, your pilgrimage.
Yeah. So this was all aftermath of August 12th. And that whole summer of hate, 2017. And so, as part of, I think we're on a path of, what are these committees called? I mean, truth and reconciliation. And so as part of that, once again, Jelaine Schmidt and Andrea Douglas, who is the director of the Jefferson School African American Heritage Center, organized this pilgrimage to the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama. The purpose, or one of the premise for this, was taking soil from the known lynching that took place in Albemarle County in 1898 of John Henry James. Again, that happened right outside of Farmington. Well, actually, the property is owned by Farmington now. But nonetheless, he was pulled off a train, hanged for, you know, an accusation that he had attacked a young white woman. That's a very typical a premise for that sort of action. And at the same time, in the Equal Justice Initiative opened its memorial, its lynching memorial there, which, I mean, I just think everyone should see it. It is so stunning, with these rectangles hanging with the names of the person and the location where lynching, and there are thousands of lynchings in the U.S. Anyway, so we took this trip. There was about 100 people from Charlottesville on these miserable buses that were so uncomfortable. And we stopped and hit like every civil rights memorial between here and Alabama. And so it was just, it was so intense. It was definitely a learning experience for me, because, you know, I grew up on the Lost Cause narrative. And as a lot of people my age were, and even when you're aware of the civil rights movement and what's changed since then, and you realize what hasn't changed, and it was just eye opening. It was horrifying to, you know, look at our history of racial terrorism and what we as a country have done to people of a different color. So we hit all these places, and it just, it was unlike anything I've ever done. And I'm so glad I got to do that. And, but yes, that was my big week-long trip to sort of the heart of darkness.
Yeah. there was one of the things that they had when you got down to what's the proper name of where you went, the initiative, Equal Justice Initiative Memorial.
It has a name that is called Peace and Justice. I have to look it up, really.
But they had, you were taking the soil down there, and it went into a jar where they had soil for everyone, for all the other lynchings, where all the other lynchings had taken space on a wall that looked incredible.
It's, again, they do such good work there, and it's something everyone should see, but also just, it's a horrible legacy to see on the walls there.
Just a moment left, 30 seconds. Advice?
Well, another interview I did that I thought was really great was getting to talk to Dan Rather, the legendary CBS newsman. And I was asking him, why should young people go into journalism at this point, you know, when you have a leader saying we're the enemy of the people? But he said, I just thought it was so great. He said, you know, being a journalist, you get to have a lot of experiences that most people don't have. And I was like, right on, Dan. You're... I also got to ask him if he had any dirt on Walter Cronkite.
Lisa Province, thank you so much.
Thank you, Rick, for having me on.
Next week, you'll hear the Santa phone calls as he calls the kids. All right, everybody, thank you so much. Take care.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC-LP, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Engineering assistance was by Mike Friend. The Wake-Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at cvillepodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake-Up Call, only on WPVC-LP Charlottesville.